Hello, and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast provides updates based on the expertise and insights from the attorneys at the Washington, D.C.-based law firm, Fortney Scott, and their guests. This podcast will provide an analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand and is for informational purposes only and does not provide legal advice. Now let's turn it over to our host, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone. This is David, and welcome to another edition of the DC Insider Employer Update. We've got the gang back again, and I've got both Nita Beecher. Hey, Nita.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. And Bert Fishman. Hi, Bert.
Hi, David. Hi, Nita. Glad to be back.
Me too. Well, before we jump in, because there's a lot of stuff we'd like to unpack, I just would like to note, as we're recording this today, we're, of course, right in the middle of the peak cherry blossom blooms, which is one of the absolute best times of year. Even though it is raining and windy and cold outside, it's still cherry blossom season. So that's reason for optimism.
I hear they're going to cut some of the trees down. That has been a big controversy.
The tidal basin is rising and tree stumps are getting inundated with seawater every year. And they're finally going to raise the seawall. If people didn't believe in climate change in Congress, they can look out their window and see evidence of it.
Fair enough. But the good news is, after they fix the seawall and raise up everything, we're going to have new cherry trees. The tradition will continue and hopefully be completely uninterrupted, as I understand the production schedule. So, well, that's exciting. I wish that we had as much confidence that some of the agencies and things we're talking about were going to be fixed that timely and that effectively, but perhaps not. You know, we're getting to the point now where in the final run, final 9-10 months of the Biden administration, whether it's Biden 1.0, and we're going to see who gets the second term, whether it's President Biden or President Trump. Of course, we don't know that. But what happens with the workplace agencies is continually informed by, and I think affected by, the end of the Biden term and what's going on. Of course, big news, we have a budget. I might add, I think that's personally a fairly pathetic low bar to say that Congress actually enacted a budget, but that's what we've fallen to here in Washington. So we do have a budget for the remainder of this fiscal year, which means at least through September 30th, we have a budget. It also means that there's very limited new bandwidth for the agencies. They basically were flatlined. The Labor Department ends up with $14.4 billion, what it had effectively last year, and the EEOC's in at $455 million. So flattened budgets, along with new responsibilities, new regulatory efforts, and a flat budget, by the way, effectively means at least a 5% cut because federal agencies have to give a scheduled increase. So it means that the staffing isn't even guaranteed to remain the same at that level. But I do think that with all of that, the responsibilities still continue apace. I want to talk a little bit about child labor, new construction obligations that OFCCP is grappling with. EEOC has brand new regulatory requirements under the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act that they're trying to roll out. And Bert, what about the agency that you focus on a lot, the board?
NLRB got flatlined again. And even though they have more representation elections and more litigation and now constitutional challenges, they have the same amount of dough as last year, but 5% goes to increased wages, so they have a 5% cut.
Well, certainly labor, one of their points that they were highlighting in the run-up to the budget discussions was wage hour and specifically trying to leverage child labor and pointing out that they were losing staff, they didn't have resources to more robustly police those areas. But nonetheless, it just seems it didn't ultimately move the needle. They got what they had before. So Bert, let's start with the NLRB. So we've got these agencies that have been flatlined, but that certainly is the agency that's been the most active among all the workforce agency. Whatever their budget is, they're making a lot of waves.
They sure are. They're not only the most active, they're the most aggressive, and in some respects, the most successful. It's raised the profiles of the agency and of unions. But for our purposes this afternoon, I'd like to focus on some of the decisions of the NLRB that affect all employers, regardless of union status, so that it doesn't matter whether you have a union or not, these decisions affect you and your workforce. For example, there's a case called Stericycle, which really effectively made it all but impossible for an employer to enforce conduct rules in their workplace. I'm not kidding. A rule as simple as be civil to our customers and to each other has been found to be an unfair labor practice because it limited the employees' rights to protected concerted activity. Something similar without the benefit of a new regulation. There was another NLRB decision that changed the classification of independent contractors to employees. That's a case called Atlantic Opera. And probably the one you've heard most about, to the consternation of the EOC, abusive, sexist, racist speech is now tolerated in a case called Lion Elastomers. And that's caused enormous upset and confusion among the employers who are facing a workplace harassment claim on the one hand and an NLRB unfair labor practice on the other. And there's been efforts between the NLRB and the EEOC to try to do guidances or something, but it seems window dressing.
It's interesting. Today, our colleague Leslie Silverman was commenting, a former vice chair of the EEOC was at the ABA meeting last week, as I understand it, giving, shall we say, the NLRB general counsel a piece of her mind as far as how little guidance there is. And, you know, one of the things that was pointed out is that one incident of saying the N-word can lead to a violation under Title VII. So if you're going to let people make those kinds of comments under the board, where does that put the employer, David and Bert?
There's case law that defines, certainly under Title VII, the point that you made. And even though these agencies early on, and we were quite supportive and recognized, the agencies entered into these MOUs that basically said, we're going to coordinate. We're not going to leave people in the lurch. And with the points, Bert and Nita, that you've both described, whether it's the NLRB being the handbook police and what policies you can have or what statements you can make or not make, and does one statement, an offensive statement, protected or not protected under one statute, but that can be disciplined and should be disciplined under the discrimination statutes. I mean, that's unnecessary. These agencies could have and should have. They knew this issue. They knew this issue was coming. And I, for one, think they left us in the lurch and it wasn't necessary. They could have. Now, they've said they're going to fix it, but why did we have to be where we are today?
Well, you know, David, that's the question that employers across the country are asking. And, you know, there's something else that our audience should understand. They probably read that all these new precedents are being challenged in the courts. You have to remember that for the NLRB, you can have a decision struck down in, say, the Sixth Circuit. They don't care. They're going to continue to enforce it everywhere else until there's a Supreme Court ruling. So if you're an employer, especially a multi-state employer, you may have different rules in different buildings of your own business. And just to remind everyone that in the past, we have covered some other of these new precedents that have focused on union organizing, and we are at the lip of getting bargaining orders without elections and union recognitions without votes. And these rapid changes are confusing to both labor and management. And I think we're going to see more of it.
I'm very disappointed, to be honest, guys. I feel like the agencies are playing gotcha with the employers. They won't tell you what are the rules anymore. I think we feel that way about OFCCP to some extent, which we'll talk about in a minute. I think child labor, we feel that way on occasion. And certainly with the board, we feel that way. And I think that's unfair to not tell you what the rules are and then hold you responsible for something you didn't know was a problem.
Some political philosophers have said that the principal rule, the first rule of a democratic republic, is to know the rules by which you will be judged. And that's not happening.
Well, we'll see how that goes. Well, Nita, I want to come back to you. Let's talk about the EEOC. I mean, the NLRB is out there, aggressive, and Bert has highlighted that. What about the commission?
You know, it's interesting. We didn't get our third Democratic commissioner until like November of last year. And yet, 2023, fiscal year 2023, was a record year. They recovered $665 million. $150 million more than 2022 and $35 million more than the last highest recovery they ever had, which is fascinating. They did receive over 81,000 charges in 2023. That was a little more than usual. They've got a little bit of an increase in their pile They did fill 490 positions. So unlike some of the other agencies we've talked about, Charlotte was able to get 490 folks into the EEOC, which I think is pretty good. I mean, in their report that they issued, these are primarily frontline people, which is the people they're losing, the investigators, the frontline lawyers, and so forth. They filed 143 lawsuits, which was up from 91 the year before. So they were really busy. I think the most interesting thing around this report, though, is the 35 commissioner's charges that were filed last year. I think we've talked a little bit before about how we feel like, especially Stephen Miller's group, is filing these civil rights complaints with the EEOC, demanding they investigate the DE&I practices of these various employers, many famous corporations. We suspect that some of these 35 commissioner's charges are in fact doing that, because Commissioner Lucas, who David, I think you're going to be talking to in a podcast, has a very strong view about what employers are doing around DE&I.
Yeah, it's opaque to us. We don't know. And under law, they can't talk about what is a pending charge and whether a commissioner files a charge. So it's hard for us to have visibility. It seems that Mr. Miller and his group, though, they're certainly free as the one that files a, and you use the right nomenclature, a complaint, which basically they write a letter to EEOC and says, hey, would you look at this employer? And then they issue a press release. You know, we think this employer is unfair, and we just sent a letter down to EEOC to complain about it, which is kind of tough. But then after that, we don't have much insight as to what occurs or how it occurs, but it's become an important component of the DEI controversy, how that's rolling out and some of the issues there. Do you see the EEOC doing anything more about that, Dina?
As you probably know, on March the 1st, the House Republicans demanded that EEOC tell them what they're doing about these complaints about DE&I practices. They demanded that they provide by March 15th a bunch of documentation on how they're enforcing Title VII in these situations. So I think what we really need, and again, I don't think we're going to get it, what we really need is some more up-to-date guidance. We only have the 1979 guidance around what voluntary affirmative action. It would be really helpful to have a little more guidance than what we've had from the agency, something that employers can rely on.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath on that, but it's possible, I suppose. Anything else going on of note within the EEOC?
Just a couple of quick things. One, they do have the harassment guidance, which again is guidance, not a regulation, is up at OMB. We're waiting for the pregnant worker fairness regs. And I think the other thing to mention is they issued on Equal Pay Day a chart which showed data from the 2017 and 2018, we call it component two, pay data collection. And so that was interesting. It didn't show anything we didn't know, but it was interesting, and it might give some evidence of what industries you might see EEOC go after, for example.
You know, one thing, those Pregnancy Worker Fairness Act, PWFA regulations that by statute were required by December, they've sent them over to OMB to be finalized, but they've had a series of meetings with stakeholders, and clearly, because there's a public record of when the meetings occur, abortion is the issue, and a very interesting series of representatives, I'll call them from the expected stakeholders on those issues, but also from the office of the vice president, not someone who typically participates in rulemaking discussions, but OVP, as they're known on the records there, does show up at the meetings in which clearly abortion is the topic du jour. Now, OVP, the views of the vice president are very well known vis-a-vis abortion, and that's part of the campaign strategy. So that may explain, because some people are saying, well, why aren't those regs being finalized? It would appear that they've run aground on the abortion issue, or at least that's proving a bit of a sticking point in finalizing and issuing the final regs. They're past due, so any day now, but we'll see how that issue works through.
So David, we're turning the tables on you. We would like for you to talk about your former agency, DOL.
Wow. Okay. Well, so the Labor Department, it's interesting, we have the longest acting Secretary of Labor, Julie Sue. She is confirmed only as the Deputy Secretary. In the dark of night, literally on a Saturday night, she was rammed out of committee by a vote. Chair Sanders, Bernie Sanders, was able to do that on a straight party line vote. You'll notice that the Majority Leader Schumer has not brought that nomination to the floor because he's been told point blank, including by some of his Democratic members, we're not going to vote for Sue to be confirmed as Secretary of Labor. We don't think she should be, if you will, promoted to that position. So it puts the president as the most self-proclaimed and, I think, accurately, most pro-labor president in the history of the office as having this acting secretary that even members of his own party won't confirm. And I think that ultimately does impact the operations of the Labor Department. It just does. It's different when you have an acting person. I've been acting solicitor. Bert, you've been acting solicitor. It's different. It's different.
Yeah.
So I think that that's something they've really tried to double down, particularly Wage Hour is probably the most active among their agencies at labor at this point. Child labor, we've mentioned on that. We've talked about that before. They're leaning into that. That didn't move Congress. They do periodically put some out there. I haven't put much positive guidance out for employers. It's more of a gotcha type operation. Kind of they're imposing a strict liability. Not sure that's accurately what the law is. They have the regulations. We're still waiting for the final white collar exemption, the so-called white collar regulations. Those are due again any moment. I view they're going to issue those because they don't want them to be subject to Congressional Review Act. And of course, they have the other regulation on independent contractor that is being judicially challenged, but at least for the moment is in effect. One other agency that I think is worth just noting quickly that we follow is OFCCP. And speaking of acting, they have an acting head of OFCCP. Now, why? And I'm not questioning Michelle Hodge as the individual. I mean, if Michelle Hodge is the right person in the view of the Biden administration to be the head of OFCCP, why not name her? You don't even need to have that position confirmed. That is just the White House and the secretary gets to do that. Why do we still have, after over a year since Jenny Yang left, approaching a year and a half, why do we still have an acting head of OFCCP? That, again, speaks poorly as to the priority, the importance of OFCCP to this administration. So there's a lot of things I don't understand about that. And I think the Labor Department, notwithstanding having a really strong solicitor of labor and some other strong folks, I think Doug Parker's pretty strong at OSHA, they seem to be having trouble getting stuff out the door, ultimately, throughput.
I will say that we did finally hear, this is so typical of what we've seen it with this particular OFCCP. Last year, they issued the final changes to the scheduling letter on a Friday and said they're effective today. And on the 25th, they said, we're going to open the portal on April 1, which was a week later. Now, it just opening, they've got several months before you have to file. But it's fairly typical of them not to really give you a whole lot of lead time.
Not real strong rollout, I would say. But federal contractors, to Nita's point, you do have to go back to the portal again this year and re-register. Well, Bert, beyond the agencies, the courts, who I personally think is the branch among the three branches, the branch that is really active is continuing to make waves in our corner of the pond, don't you think?
Yeah, well, you know, Alex Pickle called them the least dangerous branch, and I think people are thinking he might revise his opinion. Let's just talk about what the courts have been active in. We've talked about Chevron, that is to say the traditional deference given to the agencies, which is being challenged. And you can already see the effect. I think, David, that's one of the reasons all of these agencies are being so slow and so careful in issuing their new regulations. They fear having them challenged and even struck down. But let's look what's happening. It's happened. The NLRB's joint employer regulation was struck down in Texas virtually the day it came into effect. The decision focused as a indicator of employment, and it said that was absolutely wrong. So we are back to the 2020 rule, which the NLRB doesn't like and wanted to supplant, and now that's the rule that they have to enforce. This has real impact, and also I think it has real impact on the Department of Labor's independent contractor regulation. One of the key elements of the independent contractor regulation was this notion of indirect control is one of the six factors that determines whether someone's independent or not. That's already been thrown out in the joint employer litigation, and that means it's a ready-made challenge to the independent contractor regulation, and I think it's going to be challenged in the very same court. So hold your breath a bit on whether the independent contractor reg is going to have a long life. And that's typical of the kind of problems these regulations are having when you have a very skeptical and even contrary judiciary.
You know, Bert, one of the other judicial developments that I think is very interesting, and we've flagged this issue before, but I don't want people to forget it, so I kind of want to re-raise it again, which is, what is the president's power under the Procurement Act? And if you think about it, we have at least three major examples where the president, exercising power under the Procurement Act, has imposed obligations on federal contractors. We had the OSHA vaccine mandate. We have the $15 minimum wage, the super minimum wage, if you will, applicable to federal contractors. And of course, we have Executive Order 11246, just because that's been longstanding. It's all grounded on the same core legal point. And whether general pronouncements in the Procurement Act of providing efficiency for the government in the procurement process is sufficient to justify the build out of these additional obligations. I think that ultimately, all those programs are going to face judicial challenges that are likely to be successful. But most recently, the focus has really been on the $15 super minimum wage, if you will, for federal contractors. That's pending in two circuits, the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit. Last week in the Fifth Circuit, the states, that's Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, filed their brief, and I thought very persuasively argued there is no there there. They previously won at the district court. They're not plowing new ground. Similarly, the Ninth Circuit in real time is looking at challenges by Nebraska, Idaho, Indiana, and South Carolina that make the same arguments, which is the executive can't unilaterally, just based on the Procurement Act, impose all of these substantive programs on federal contractors. I think that we should be ready that irrespective of what the Supreme Court does on Chevron and some of these other issues, this is really a major question, and does the statute, in fact, just authorize it? And I think many courts are getting increasingly likely to say, no, it doesn't.
I think as a general principle, the Supreme Court has shown the way to the lower courts to be less reticent about overturning these long-lived precedents, such as the executive order. And I think it has strengthened their willingness to take on issues from the position, from their own conservative point of view. And I think we're going to have some rather startling decisions in the near term.
Finally, just touching on one of the trends that we're seeing is the question of standing. It's come up in the most recent challenge involving abortion cases. But in the labor area, it's quite a common situation that a trade association or an interest group tries to bring a challenge to a regulation. And there's often a question, is there a so-called associational standing? And the key thing is that the association has to be able to point to one of its members, at least as a representative member, and say, here's the actual harm. Here's the problem that our member has with this regulation. And the harm that this member has is, if you will, representative of other members. And typically under pretty well settled law, that gives the association standing to challenge regulation. What we're seeing now is in the zeal to bring these challenges, not all associations are dotting the I's and crossing the T's in doing that. This issue has been raised in some of the challenges to the apprenticeship programs, project labor agreement requirements that have come up. And so I think that that's something to watch. It's not necessarily a hard point, but you've got to get your ducks in a row or else you're just getting an advisory opinion, which is not permitted.
And honestly, David, as Bert was saying, I think Supreme Court kind of opened this door because it's pretty clear from some of their previous opinions. And as a loyal alum of the University of North Carolina, where they did not prove that anyone actually didn't get admitted, I think that the court allowed that. And now they're realizing, they seem to, at least yesterday, say, oh, standing is, you need to have standing here. So we'll see.
We've seen that. And we've seen that for the challenges to some of the DEI programs. You know, there's sort of great fanfare that the appellate courts are pushing back on those. They're not pushing back on whether you can have a DEI challenge. They're pushing back on this basic jurisdictional. Is there standing? So is there an actual case or controversy between the party before the court? That is an essential question that needs to be addressed.
We saw that in the argument yesterday in the medical abortion case. The real issue was the people who brought the case could not show that they or anyone they treated was actually harmed. And we're hoping that the court points to that and makes that the basis for its ruling so that the lower courts get the point that you actually have an injured party and a case or controversy.
I expect they'll go there. Well, What are the trends? What do we see from all of this as the agencies are hopefully, I would say from their perspective, trying to sprint towards the finish line? I'll do the first takeaway that I see in all this, tepidness. Putting aside the NLRB, and particularly the general counsel of the NLRB, Ms. Abruzzo is not tepid. The other agencies seem to be having some difficulty. Maybe they were trying to keep their head down so they didn't get whacked in the budget process. Maybe now that they have a final budget, they've got a clear lane for the next 6+ months. Are we going to see them sprint forward? I'm skeptical, but maybe. I see tepidness. Bert?
Well, let me overstate the obvious and just say that the Book of Judges is replacing the Constitution. We are in what is called a critocracy, where the judges are the leaders. It is pretty clear that the Supreme Court is dictating the laws of the land, regardless of the executive, with Congress doing nothing to stop it.
I have to say, I'm really surprised that we're not seeing more from EEOC, OFCCP, and others pushing back on these challenges to DE&I. I mean, they really have not supported employers the way you would have expected.
Well, and I just would add to that, I, Bert, agree with both you and Nita on your points. And on this last point that Nita makes, my gosh, you have an agency that's whole reason for existence is affirmative action. Why aren't they framing the debate as to what is lawful affirmative action and leading that discussion, not being, you know, kind of the punchline and subject to whatever comes out of this? It's surprising to me, particularly for this administration, that they're not willing to join that issue. Well, what do we know?
Just to put a final point, David, the EEOC is really fighting for the soul of its agency. And if I were them, I would do something to let the world know exactly what they stand for.
They must have decided it's too hot to handle, Bert. That's all I can think of. Well, all right. Listen, we will be back with more discussion on these developments and more as they continue apace. I think the courts are going to be a rich treasure trove as we move forward. The agencies may or may not return to some level of activity that we'll be discussing. But I want to thank both Nita and Bert. Thanks again. I always enjoy these discussions. Those out there, if you haven't yet done so, please subscribe. DC Insider, Employer Update, it's real easy. Just hit that subscribe button. And if you've got ideas or topics you'd like to hear us chat about, shoot them to us. We get some of our best ideas from our readers and listeners, and I always appreciate that. All righty, that's it for today. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update, the podcast that provides analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand. You can subscribe to the DC Insider Employer Update podcast wherever you get your podcasts, which includes Apple, Spotify, and Google. Additional information about our podcast is located on the Fortney Scott website at fortneyscott.com. Thanks again for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update.